Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us.
No need to grab your shovels today. You ain't gonna need them.
Instead of taking you all inside the war room with us today, we're going to take a seat across the table with someone we think you should know. But let's be honest, if you don't know this guy, you're pretty much doing true crime wrong.
Welcome to the table.
This guy is known as the mayor of CrimeCon. He's a correspondent on a little old show. The OG of true crime TV shows. Dateline. And he's the brains and the voice behind the mic on some hit true crime podcast.
All right. Hang on a second. Jessica is being way too humble in this open. Listen, she's been working with this guy for a couple of years now on some podcasts I'm pretty sure you've heard of. Both seasons of Dateline's Missing in America, which won a Clue Award at CrimeCon this year for Outstanding Episodic Podcast Series. And she was his producer for a brand new long-form podcast that launched earlier this month and dominated the true crime universe.
All true. But geez, y'all can't see it, but I am blushing. And sorry, Todd, but this guy is my other partner in true crime and my friend. This is Across the Table with Josh Mankiewicz. Well, I'm excited because I have both of my partners in crime in one place to talk all about you, Josh Mankiewicz.
About me?
About you. All about you.
The show's okay. About you. We've rebranded it. It's no longer called The Investigators. This is called Talking to Josh Mankiewicz.
Okay. I'm not sure that's going to work, but we'll see.
That might violate a contract or two.
Could be. I don't know. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
Nice to see you in person.
Yeah, we only
sort of.
Yeah, we only get to see each other at CrimeCon or when we're screening with, 20 other people. So yeah,
I know. When did I see Todd last? I guess CrimeCon, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they're at the booth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were quite busy. You're always quite busy at CrimeCon.
It's really something, I got to say. It's an experience every year.
So I kind of want to open this up with talking about something that you and I've worked on together, Josh, because it's kind of exciting. And when we release this episode, people will be able to go and binge the full season of what we're about to talk about. Right. And it's some crazy shit. There's even a book called Twisted Faith.
Yeah. Crazy shit might be better, actually. might be the title we should go for. It's really nutty. It really is. This is the podcast that that Jess and I have worked on that brand new. Now here's the interesting thing. The book on this case was called A Twisted Faith by a guy named Greg Olson, who we also interview in the podcast. And that was the original working. That was the title of the podcast internally when we talked about it, but we decided not to call it that because, we don't want to give it the same title as that guy's book. We don't really have anything to do with him. We have no business relationship with him, but we did interview him for this story. So then we were looking around for other things we could call it. Deadly Sin, we were going to call it. And then we did a title search and discovered that Deadly Sin is taken. So it's not going to be called Deadly Sin. And then we were going to call it So Help Me God. But that is also taken. It's also the title of Mike Pence's autobiography, which laid out, I think, the compelling case for why he should be president. And then we were looking at Where There's Smoke. And I think that is also taken. So crazy shit could actually be back in the running.
I guarantee it's probably not taken, at least in this.
Probably not.
In this part of the genre, in this particular genre.
We could put an asterisk in where the I is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm not sure exactly as we go to press here. I'm not exactly sure what the title's going to be, but it will be the latest Dateline podcast, and it will be narrated by me and written by a team of people, including me and Jessica, which is always a pleasure. It is a crazy story. It is.
From what I understand, I just got to do a cursory read today on it to get caught up a little bit to prep for this. But is this your first long form podcast where it's a full season?
No, I've done two others. Okay. I did one called Motive for Murder a couple of years ago about some murders in Texas. And I did another one called Internal Affairs about some things that went on in the Greeley, Colorado Police Department. This is a story that happened outside of Seattle back in the late 90s. A small church called a Christ Community Church, a charismatic church, that did a lot of very unusual things. First of all, when you signed up to be a member of this church, one of the things that happened was you had to divulge a huge number of your secrets. Like you had to say whether, you know, you were an alcoholic or whether you had gone to rehab or whether you'd ever had an abortion or whether you'd ever cheated on your spouse or partner. A certain amount of bearing of one's soul is required to get in the door here, I understand. And that, that figured later on because it made it a little harder for people to leave if they wanted to, because now somebody else knew all of their secrets. But that's not the central issue here. The central issue is what happened with the guy who was the youth pastor, a young man named Nick Hackney, who came home from a hunting trip the day after Christmas, discovered his house was in flames. His wife had died in the fire while he was out hunting. And he was a young guy. They didn't have any kids. It was just the two of them. And he then, the church kind of rallied around him after that awful thing happened. And he then used that as a way of getting into bed, literally, with many members of his congregation, the sympathy that they felt for him. These were God-fearing people. And he did it by convincing them that going to bed with him was what God wanted. It was part of God's plan. Oh, we were also going to call the podcast God's Plan, and it turns out that's taken too.
Oh, well, actually, one of my ideas was God's Gift because of everything he had laid out in this.
Well, he used to say to people, right, that he was God's gift. He would describe himself as God's gift. Now, completely apart from like how you might feel about him or whether you felt sorry for him, if there's somebody that I know and they describe themselves to me as God's gift, getting involved with them romantically or sexually is not something that's going to follow from that. But man, he really made it work.
And that's the same underlying theme in a lot of cases that center around some kind of religious order or a church. And there's a project I'm working on where that's one of the underlying themes, but it's this theme of blind faith leads one vulnerable to manipulation, right? When you just totally just let down your defenses and say, this is a person, this is a clergyman, I can 1000% trust them.
And so therefore, whatever they say, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's just opens the door for some really bad shit.
Yeah, it really does. And the one thing I will say, and the one thing I want people to keep in mind when they're listening to this podcast, this happened in 1997. And this was before not before all the abuses occurred with clergy, but before a lot of them received sort of widespread mainstream coverage. It was before the Boston Globe spotlight series. It was before a lot of the work was done on that. So it was probably for some of those people a much more difficult thing to believe that your pastor wasn't telling you the truth and that he was operating, you know, from some personal need as opposed to what God wanted. I mean, I do want to sort of, it's what these folks fell for is regrettable, but it did occur in a slightly different time where that was maybe a little bit more believable.
Yeah, and it came from a place of innocence and earnestness, yep. Like, hey, this is what I was taught, and I'm in 1,000%.
Totally. And, you know, he was very good at it. He was very good at sort of ingratiating himself. And, you know, not only, I mean, he had this two-pronged approach. I mean, he had the sympathy they already felt for him because he was a widower at 27. And then he had, you know, God as his wingman.
And by the way, that's my favorite line in the entire podcast.
Yeah, well,
it's a great one. Yeah.
God is my wingman, maybe should be the title. So
it should be. Yeah.
Something interesting to me about this case, beyond all the intricate details and twists and turns of the case itself, is the fact that you started looking into this case back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And so what was it like for you to kind of, you know, come back 15, 20 years later and look at this case again? What was that like for you?
Well, we did this as a Dateline episode back in the early 2000s, I think, was when it finally aired. But yeah, I mean, we were looking at it back in the 90s. And what was interesting is listening to my interviews with the women back then who were fooled by Nick Hackney. 25 years of Dateline, this is not going to come as a shock, I don't think. 25 years of Dateline has made me significantly more cynical. And of course, a lot of things have happened in the world, like we talked about, right? Like abuses by the Catholic Church and other clergy. But, you know, my attitude now, when confronted with somebody who was essentially telling the story that these women told back then, would be, are you effing serious? You fell for that? What's wrong with you? What if God had said, I want to knock over a 7-Eleven? Are you going out to get a ski mask? I mean, what is wrong with you?
God is my getaway driver.
Yeah, God's my wheelman. That's the next one. Yeah. There you go. That's the next one Jess and I are doing. Yeah. But, you know, I did not take that tack back then I'm glad, because I listen to these interviews now and I just sort of let the women talk a little bit more and didn't challenge them. I did a little bit, but not in a way that would upset them. I think, you know, we were fortunate enough to get on camera interviews with two of the women involved in this, which is like very, very hard to believe that we would get that now. People who have done things, I'm not even talking about these women didn't do anything illegal, but doing something embarrassing like that is not something that people want to talk about on television, but we did. And so you'll hear some of those interviews in this podcast. And, you know, today I would approach them differently, and I'm not sure that that's a good thing. I'm actually glad that I was significantly softer with them, you know, as opposed to shouting, you know, WTF. You know, like, how could you possibly have thought that this was legit? I mean, come on.
Right.
But, you know, as I say, it was a different time, and I was a nicer guy.
That's a tough line, though. It is, like, especially like you said, in today's world. But when you're a detective long enough, the kind of the same thing happens just because of the one case after another. But, you have to find that place within yourself, which obviously you did, where it's like, I can't let the obvious naivety of this person interfere with the result, you know, what happened to them. So that means you would have been a good detective, basically.
Well, the wrestling with suspects part, I wouldn't have been good at, but
were you not a grappler growing up? Were you more of a reason the stout?
Yeah. I don't, what are we fighting for? Come on. Yeah.
Let's talk about
it. Yeah. I don't think I'd be officer of the month. But thank you. A detective who I will not name, who was is a major crimes detective in a major American city, just sent me a video of today of her, which I wish I could put up here, of her walking into an interview room to talk with a guy who's charged with multiple armed robberies, which he'd committed in a bunch of different jurisdictions. So when they finally bring him in, there's like five or six detectives from different departments in the next room watching on TV, thinking like, okay, finally, this is our guy. And, you know, she walks in, the guy is at the table, the camera obviously is facing the guy, and you know it'll be over the detective's shoulder. The guy has his head in his hands when the video starts, because he's been locked up, right? This is it. And she comes in, she got a big sheaf of papers. She comes in, she says, hi, how you doing? She puts the papers down on the table, and she sits down, and she misses the chair and falls on her ass, right? And the guy says, and the suspect says, are you okay? She's laughing, and it's like, you know, I said to her, you know, that's a very disarming way to start an interview. She's like, yeah, and he ended up going for it at the end. He copped to one of them.
It broke the ice.
Yeah, she said, that wasn't my plan. She said, I forgot where the chair was. But she really falls. She doesn't just almost fall. She's like on the floor with her feet pointed toward the ceiling. Nice. Yeah.
Those are the best moments, though. When you look back on your career, like, it's always all the stories I tell on stage in my career are all like of self-deprecation. Like those moments where my leg fell asleep from sitting in the car too long as an old man and fell on my ass as I went out to get in the foot pursuit. You know, those are the things you most remember. And I thought your story for a moment was going to go a different direction, because it mirrored what happened to me one time. I was brand new and I let my guard down for a moment, trying to be Mr. Officer Friendly, unhandcuffed the guy at this tiny jail. I'm the only person in the county working. There is a dispatcher who's a retired officer who was this gigantor of a man, an older man, but a gigantor of a man. And he's working dispatch and he's also the jailer. I took his handcuffs off, got on the other side of the counter, started to fill out his fingerprint card before we fingerprint, and he sucker punches me. Just whack, while my head's down like an idiot, not paying attention. And for some reason, it just caught me where it didn't hurt. It just moved my head, basically. But it looked horrible on camera. And I was in shock. And I was just like, okay, are we done? And he was like, I got that out of my system. Done. Sorry I did that. And I was like, okay. So I sit there and I just start to fill out the card again. And then on the camera, you can see like 30 seconds later, big old George comes through, opens the door, and whoosh, you just see the guy disappear. George just snatched him up and went off camera. And, so those are the moments you wish you could, like, can I just have all the footage of all the dumb shit that happened?
That's great. That's great. So that's not an escape attempt. He just was striking out against the system that locked him up.
Just lost his mind for a second. Like, oh, I'm going to fight. And then I guess when I was just like, I disarmed him probably accidentally, but like, did that just happen? Are we done? And he's like, yeah, sorry, I don't even know why I did that.
Wow. All right. I want my lawyer. Yeah. Okay.
Have you ever, with that in mind, you've talked to some very bad people, I assume, in your day. Sure. Like, did you ever find yourself in a compromising position where, whether or not anything happened, you were like, boy, this is really unnerving?
Nearly all the times when we talk with, you know, murderers or accused murderers or people who are locked up ahead of trial, you know, they're on their best behavior because they're trying to persuade us and the audience, you know, that person described in court, that isn't me. I loved her. I would never kill her. It, you know, they got it all wrong. So they're usually, you know, trying to sort of charm us a little bit. And then they're also in the middle of telling us what's almost always some sort of preposterous story of why they're not actually guilty of this and how the evidence can be explained in a completely different way. So you're listening to that and you're going to debate that with them a little bit. One time I was in a prison, a guy had been convicted, although he had only pretty recently been convicted. He hadn't been in there even a year yet, I don't think. And he was in there for killing his girlfriend, and her body had never been found. And so I was in the process of asking him or saying to him, look, this is over. I mean, you're here. You're going to be here for 30 years or whatever it was. And if you could tell that family where she is, then you would have done one good thing with your life here, which did not work with him. And he got very angry and he started shouting at me. And we were in, you know, normally, you know, when we do these interviews, it's like corrections officers, like right here off camera, just like right at the edge of the right here. But in this case, like the room we were interviewing in was a little too small for anybody else to be in. So they were right outside the door, but they were on the other side of a wall out in the hallway. And they knew my producer so well, because we'd done so many stories in that state and probably in that prison, that they were kind of like, you know, these guys are fine. I don't have to worry about them. So as this guy was getting angry and shouting at me, I thought to myself, he's a big guy too. This guy's about to kick my ass, and this is going to be seen by everyone. Right? We were thinking this will be a very famous piece of video. I was actually looking ahead to like dealing with this on social for the next, you know, 8 years
or
something.
You're building the story around it. Right. It's happening.
Yeah. And I saw the cameraman close his hand on the lid of an equipment case, which was near his tripod, because he thought this guy's going to charge and I'm going to have to hit him with this thing. Right. which would have been a significant weapon.
Right.
And then the guy like had some brief moment of self-control, sad that he hadn't exercised that when he killed his girlfriend. Yeah. This was like the second best time that he could have exercised that. And he thought to himself, if I pound the shit out of a TV reporter on television, it's going to feel good briefly, but then right. later, it will not feel good. And I will lose, you know, whatever privileges I have here, and I'll be, you know, it's a bad way to begin my stint in the slam. And he thought better of it. He got him walked out, and then we talked to him, and he came back in. And my rule has always been, long before I was at Dateline, my rule has always been, if you get up and walk out, I'm going to use that, because that's like saying, I did it. I agree. I it's a confession. I can't face these questions. But if you come back and you answer all the questions, then I won't use it, because then you were willing to be confronted.
What a great rule, by the way.
Right? Right.
Yeah.
So he came back, and we did not use him leaving, although we did use him yelling at me. Yeah. Yeah. Which we had to bleep a few words, but that's the only time I thought that this is going to end with me in bruises. Otherwise, no, you know, by the time they're facing us, the fight's usually out of them. Yeah. Now I have interviewed a couple of people. Some prisons will not let you be in the same room with the person, no matter who they are, and no matter what their crime. So you have to interview them through the glass. And that's usually unfortunate, because you want to be able to, like, you know, it's good to, like, be facing somebody, because you get some better sense of who they are and things like that. But there have been a couple where I thought to myself, I'm glad there's glass between us, because that person should not ever right. be on the other side of the glass. Yeah, that's right. A scary guy. Yeah.
I'm sure we all three have experienced this. Do you remember the first time you looked into a person's eyes and you were like, oh, this is the first time I can say I'm recognizing evil?
Yeah.
There's nothing but evil, soulless evil behind those eyes.
Yep, I sure can. Yeah, it was a guy locked up in Texas who was angry at his daughter for something, and I think couldn't bring himself to kill his daughter, so he killed her best friend.
Do you remember that feeling of, like,
oh, yeah.
probably when you got home that day, like when you settle into what you're like, wow, the world's different than I thought.
Oh, yeah. No. That's one of the guys I was thinking about when I thought, you're right where you should be. This is the criminal justice system operating perfectly, right? As opposed to, you know, not always perfectly. This is, yeah, you should be locked up. But most of them, as I say, most of them, by the time they're talking to us, they're arguing. You know, it's like talking to a political candidate, which is they have a story that they're trying to sell you. You know, this you have it wrong. It's not this. You know, it's this. It's this other unrelated thing. I was actually doing this. Okay, I'll listen to that. Doesn't mean that I will not try to poke some holes in it if there are holes in it. Always talking to the families for me is much harder than talking to the accused. Yeah, they're not getting over this. I mean, there's this mythical idea out there that there's something called closure and people will feel better after somebody's put on trial and locked up. And that's just not true. You know, I mean, maybe they'll feel better than if the person got away with it. But the criminal justice system is a pretty poor therapist. It's not going to return your loved one, and it's not going to fill that hole that the crime left.
Did you ever find yourself in a position to mentor someone like the next Josh Mankiewicz? And if so, like what advice did you give them when they had to approach interviews like that?
Okay, first of all, Jess is the next Josh Mankiewicz.
There you go. I hope so, because that can mean I could end up with some kind of behind-the-scenes job at Dateline. That would be awesome.
Right? Be sweet, right?
Mailroom's fine, by the way. Mailroom's fine. Whatever.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure there's actually any mail anymore, but okay.
the email room.
Yeah, those days room. I think are, yeah. I literally don't know when I last received a piece of actual mail at the office. It's like several years ago.
Great point.
Somebody, you know, some viewer like sent me something to our Burbank address. And of course, you know, by the time it actually got through what's left of the mail room and made it to where my office is, like, I think it was a food item, and it was not something you could eat at that point.
You know, Elizabeth Gill's family sent cookies to Rockefeller Center.
Oh, for you and me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I said to everyone, I said, well, enjoy.
Enjoy. Yeah.
But yeah, she made
homemade cookies. reminds me of a story. I was in local news here in Los Angeles. Some viewer, somebody I didn't know, sent in a big coffee can of fudge that they had made, which was smelled great. I wasn't going to eat it all, right? I couldn't like eat this giant coffee can. So I'm like passing around the newsroom, right? And everybody's eating it, right? They're all, you know, because the reporters, like, they'll eat anything for free, right? So they're all eating and eating and eating and eating. And finally, somebody says to me, I didn't know you made fudge. I'm like, me? I don't know how to make fudge. This is from some viewer. And they're like, reporters are also suspicious. They think like some viewers trying to poison all of us. Yeah, no, not true. Everybody was
unless
fine.
You put it on that middle table in the newsroom where it's just random food and it came in and you don't know where it came from, then it's okay because it's on the table.
Yeah, and then it's like locusts. Yeah. Yeah. Then it's just like whoosh, it's gone. Yeah.
It's like the NFL players, they say that, you know, when they're at a away game, they don't make it a point to go out and eat at restaurants, especially like restaurants like sports bar type restaurants, because they're always afraid, oh, you know, we got a really good chance if we give the kicker diarrhea, you know, like they're always afraid to eat something bad.
Wow. I wonder if that's ever really happened or that's just a superstition. I don't know.
I'm sure it's a superstition more than anything. Yeah.
And then you also, I mean, that's what you do is you give the kicker the spoiled wings, right? And
right.
Then you bet, and then you also bet really heavy that weekend.
It's all about the betting for sure.
Wow. That's a good story. Yeah.
But do you remember that mentoring moment where you were like able to pass on like any future journalists or new young journalists out there?
I mean, people ask me about that now and then. I mean, when you're talking to families, and you sort of referenced this earlier, and you're absolutely right, you know, you have to find some sort of middle ground between where they are and where, you know, journalists usually are. You know, people are telling you about the most terrible thing that ever happened to them. and sometimes they're crying. Now, when people start crying, I usually ask them if they want to stop, because sometimes they do. And even if they don't, it inoculates you against the idea that you kept going after they felt terrible. But and a lot of people are like, no, I always do this. It's fine. Let's go. I'm okay. I want to get through this. So you get both kinds. But, the idea of having somebody cry on camera was extremely cool in like 1970 local TV, because emotion just was something that new and something that was hardly ever presented on camera at the time. Now it's been a few years, and I'd rather have somebody composed and telling the story than somebody I can't understand who's not, who looks terrible, looks sad, miserable. So I usually ask people if they want to stop. If they do, that's fine. And then we stop. They maybe fix their makeup or whatever, clean up a little bit. But you've got to find some middle ground between crying yourself along with those people, because the stories they're telling are miserably sad. And you already know how it comes out, and it's not in a good place. And you also can't be like, hey, come on, let's go. I got to, two more interviews today, pull yourself together. Can't do that either. So you have to find some place where you can be, because, if you're not feeling anything, you're not doing this job, right? You're not just reading the questions off a sheet of paper. You've got to have some sense of what somebody else is going through. I mean, that's certainly true with good detectives, police officers. I mean, if they don't feel that you have any empathy, good luck. So you've got to find that place, whatever it is. You obviously can't be drying your eyes the same time they are. And it's different for each story.
I think that's really good advice. I actually wanted to go back a minute, because you were talking about, the first time you saw evil in someone's eyes. And it made me think back to the first time I can remember that. And it may not have been the first time, but it's the first time that has stuck with me over the years. And it was a serial killer, and I was covering his trial, but I knew I was looking at evil. And I know how I process that, but how do you process it and then form that into the story without saying, because let's say this isn't someone who has been convicted yet, this isn't an adjudicated case. How do you use that in your storytelling without going to the point of actually calling this person out as a suspect?
Well, it's not any different than when I was a political reporter and I would interview somebody whose views were tremendously noxious to me. I mean, it doesn't matter what I think about that. It never did. So you challenge them on their story points, and then you let them do the talking. And, look, the question we all ask ourselves at Dateline after interviews, before air, is when so-and-so, when Mr. Smith, who we just interviewed, when he sees this, what's he going to say? Is he going to say, I didn't get my say? Is he going to say they misrepresented me? Or is he going to say, all right, well, I got a chance to give my side. And if the person you're talking to, and maybe they haven't been convicted yet, in which case they are entitled to the same presumption of innocence anybody else is, but that doesn't mean that I'm just going to let them give a speech about how they didn't do it into the camera. I mean, there's a reporter's role in everything. If they're really that evil, that scary, it's going to come through in their words, in their interview. Like, you don't have to worry about telling people that. The audience will figure it out. And universally, they have. So
basically, you use that to your advantage in that, hey, I recognize that this is either a radical, very radical perspective this person's about to present, so I'll just ask the question and let them hang themselves on it, or this person does not even begin to understand morality or
any of these things. And that will come through.
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 20 plus years. You've been doing it for a little bit longer. So I'm curious, because I kind of struggle with this even as of late, really. How do you compartmentalize everything that we do on a daily basis, all the emotions that we shoulder and take in on all these interviews, all these cases? What do you do to, laugh besides Dr. Todd, because he's been funny.
That generally does it. You know, first of all, thank you for saying I've done this only a little longer than 20 years, which is good because I've been at, because in February I will have been at Dayline 29 years, and I was in the business another 20 years before that.
Good for you.
So, though. Yeah. But that's in base 10. Let's the way the kids do it now. I've only been in the business a very brief period of time. So, you know, I am lucky because I get this question now and then, which is like, does this stay with you? And yes, it does stay with you. But fortunately, and this is another question I get, it hasn't shown up in my dreams. I'm not dreaming about these murderers. I'm not having nightmares about the cases. I don't know why I'm not, because obviously you can't control what your subconscious wants to dream about, but it hasn't happened. So, you know, I come home and I from stories and I hang out with my wife and my friends and my family. And sometimes I talk about the stories. You know, my wife isn't in the business, so she's coming at this from the standpoint of a viewer. But, you know, how do I deal with it is like I try to leave work at work. And that seems to be something I'm able to do so far.
You're a celebrity.
And Huge. No. But
at the same time, you're not Leonardo DiCaprio or Brad Pitt or Ryan Reynolds celebrity. But I can imagine that you find yourself at times at events and stuff where there is every level of celebrity. Do you remember the first time that happened to you? Like once things started to take off and you found yourself at an event and you're like, holy shit, look at all these people. Why am I here? Why is Josh Mankiewicz here?
First of all, why is Josh Mankiewicz here is a question I ask nearly every day. I'm at home right now. I'll tell you two stories. One is Blake Lively, who's married to Ryan Reynolds.
Right.
Came up to my brother. My brother's the host of Turner Classic Movies. Mm-hmm. Blake Lively comes up to him at some event. And she's like, my husband wants to be you. And my brother was like, that's interesting because my wife wishes I were Ryan Reynolds. what a coincidence. And the other thing that happened was I used to go to this gym years ago before pandemic. I used to go to this gym on Robertson Boulevard here in LA, which was at the time sort of the hip or one of the hip shopping spots. And a lot of times I would come out of the gym and there would be a gaggle of photographers running down the street with some celebrity, some person in the middle of that, and they're snapping pictures and yelling, you know, hey, look at me, you know, right? And first of all, two things would happen. One is that I would look at the celebrity who I didn't know, and I would say to somebody who's watching with me, who is that? And they would say, oh, that's Debbie Schmorkman. And I'd be like, and she's famous, why? And they would say, oh, she's in a show called Far and Away. And I'd be like, and that could be seen where? I've never felt more out of it than when I, like, you don't know a celebrity and then someone tells you their name, you still don't know them. And they say, well, no, they have that hit song. And you're like, never heard it. That does make you feel a little out of it. The other great thing that would happen was that I would come out of the gym and there would be these photographers there who were lying in wait for these celebrities going shopping. And these photographers would simultaneously have two reflex reactions, one right after the other. One is their cameras would instantly come up because they would think to themselves, that guy's on television. And then a half second later, they would be like, oh yeah, I can't make any money with that. And their camera would go back down without them taking a picture. That'd be the great thing. That happened all the time. I'd come out and be like, no. That's
hateful. Just take it anyway. I could use a portrait.
Yeah. They'd be like, nobody wants that guy's photo. They were like, I get fired if I take too many photos of that guy.
It's that level of fame where that happens. But yeah, if you were to crash your car into a pizza shop, definitely they would want that footage. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And I would get on the 11 o'clock news for one night, but not any more than that. But look, you know, the way people are with us, with me and Keith and Andrea and Dennis at CrimeCon, that's the life that, you know, Brad Pitt and DiCaprio and Ryan Reynolds. Those guys live every day. Right. And I will say that I do understand, I mean, I was at CrimeCon this year for less than 48 hours. I mean, I arrived at like 6 o'clock on a Friday and I left at like 1 or 2 in the afternoon on Sunday. And during that time, I barely had a minute to myself, which was fine. That's why I was there, and I love meeting everybody. And I took a, you know, felt like 5,000 selfies. And I did my various appearances and meet and greets and stuff. And that was all fine. I had a great time. But those 42 hours, right? That's my taste of the life that those other people lead. And I would not want to swap that with them. You do understand why those people like have security to keep people away, because otherwise you're never alone. Again, for a day and a half, I'm fine with it. You know, I wouldn't want to live that way permanently. And yeah. I don't. So it's fine.
Well, that's good to hear. Do you have you remember the first time you met a hero, a personal hero, and kind of what that meant to you, if it went good or bad? Or
yeah, when I was 11 years old, I met Robert Vaughn, who was the star of a TV show called The Man from U.N.C.L.E., mm-hmm. Which I was devoted to, seems a little faint. fixated on, obsessed with,
right.
Freakishly obsessed with, right here in my office, I still have all 23 of the novels that were
nice.
And yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I still read through them, but I was a very,
yeah. Good, still yeah. A big piece of your heart.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a photo of him in the house here somewhere. Anyway, he was at somebody's house that we visited. And my dad said to me, you know, hey, can we go over here? And I want you to come with me on Sunday. I'm thinking like, I don't want to do that. You know, he's like, no, it'll be, come on, come with me. So I'm like, oh, man. So we get in the car and we drive, we get out of the car. And then I see him and I realize, oh, this is why dad brought me there. He was playing tennis when I saw him, Robert Vaughn was. And I remember thinking, oh, this is good, because if he were talking to me right now, I would not be able to speak because I couldn't even move. I remember like being rooted to the spot. I remember thinking like, I can't be, right? But there he was. And he played tennis for a while. And then we all played touch football. He was not on my team, so I didn't talk to him in that. But then later we were cleaning up. And clearly somebody must have said to him, like, this is your biggest fan in the whole world there, because he came over and talked to me and he was extremely nice. And I did by then, like then a couple hours had gone by and I'd managed to force a little bit of like, you know, air through my voice box. And I said a couple of things to him. He said, you know, what do you think of the show? What do you like about it? I'm thinking like everything. Right. But I didn't say that. I was like, well, here's what I like. So we talked for just a minute, not long. I mean, the whole thing was less than 5 minutes long, but he was extremely nice. He's gone now, but a nice guy.
Yeah. And I assume that's a feeling like that will never leave you. Therefore, when you're at CrimeCon, it allows you to take your mind's eye back there for a moment. Like, hey, this is a big moment for this person.
Look, this is a business. Those are the customers, you know? I mean, it's the same. Like if you ran a dry cleaners, right? And you're out at, you know, somewhere on the weekend and somebody says to him, hey, you know, Josh Mankiewicz from Frenchie's Dry Cleaners, you know, you don't say to him, leave me alone. You say, bring your shirts in, you know?
I love that analogy. I've never heard it put that way before. I might steal it. Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
Do it. Yeah. I mean, these are the people paying my salary and right. They're watching, which is, I always find astonishing. I mean, when this is the thing that I always gets me is when some little line that we wrote or some little thing we did, not the story at large, not, I love that story you did about the guy who did this and this and this. That's nice when you hear that, but like some little intricate granular detail of the story. And, you know, they say, I loved how, when the guy said, I would never do that, you went, like that.
Yeah. I gave him that look, right? Like, hmm?
Yeah. And I think, like, oh, you noticed that. Oh, you really were paying attention. You didn't just have it on in the room and you were like, you know, looking at, you know, sourdough in the oven or something like that. You were actually like, you were watching.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, still sometimes I always feel astonishing that, like, people watch these programs, they pay attention, that knowledge stays with them. It's nice.
Yeah. Is that what keeps the show and your profession in general fresh to you, or those little details, those little moments? Because it's repetitive in nature. But I know, like with comedians, if you're a person who does the same act all year, the shows can get a little monotonous. But it's that one little extra thing you said on this show that made it all worth it. Do you find that with your job?
I do, except that these stories are all different enough that it's not like the comedian doing the same act across the country. But, you know, each one of these stories is fascinating in some way. And, it, I love telling stories. I've always loved knowing stuff before anybody else did. That's one of the things that always sort of drove me to be a reporter. I love the writing. I love the interviewing. And I love the fact that here at Dateline, you can show the audience a little bit of who you are, as opposed to having to stand there like a telephone pole, like people on the evening news.
Right.
I was at a different network when I started. I can't say which one, but I just give you the initials ABC. But otherwise,
I'll Google that after.
Yeah. Word. Yeah. Okay. And they were very big on do not do anything. And I think they still are, based on the fact that everybody who works there looks and dresses like an FBI agent. They were very big on how, like, don't show any part of your personality. Don't say anything funny. Don't be snarky. Don't be rude. Don't, you know. And that sort of wasn't me. And my only, I mean, personal or professional success for me personally really only began when I decided to ignore that advice.
Makes so much sense, because it is your personality that we all gravitate toward. Like, somebody else might tell the story, but we'd rather be you. That's the position you want to find yourself in, right? Like, oh, we like how he interviews a shithead. We like how he interviews the family and gets to the bottom of the story. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's only when I decided to be myself, and that's, you know, pretty good advice for everybody, which is like, you gotta be you.
Yeah, that's great advice. Todd gave that to me like a year ago, and that's what I've started doing. It took me 20 years to get to that point, because as a journalist, it's so ingrained into you. You can't be you. You are just this person that's going to present.
Right. You're just this vessel through which the news comes. Yeah.
Yes.
And you know, Dateline under David Corvo, who is sadly retiring after a long career, he, really wanted a Josh story and a Keith story and an Andrea story and a Dennis story to sound different. You know, he wanted to make it sound as if, you know, each one of us could not read the other person's script. Like, that's, you know, this is not just a generic script being written that anybody could do. So it's a good thing. It's one of the things that's sort of kept me at Dateline and kept me so happy at Dateline all these years.
I got to say, one of my favorite things about working on some Dateline projects with you is when I'm writing with you, I have Josh Mankiewicz in my head. How would Josh Mankiewicz say this? How would he sound saying this? And then sometimes I'll read it to Todd and I'm like, how's this sound? Does this sound like Josh? This sounds like Josh. And it's funny because the ones that I'm really excited about, you know, you always keep in and I get to hear you say it, and it's perfection. It's like, yep, that was it. Wow. That was so good.
That's the best compliment I've had in a long time.
Thanks. Oh, I think it's a compliment when you leave it in there, because it's like, it's so hard to write for someone else's voice, but I love writing with your voice, because I've watched you for so many years. So it was like, oh, it was a big task, but you know, our first episode for Missing in America podcast was
great.
That was so they say don't meet your heroes. I've met mine, and he's gold.
Hey, there's Jessica's hero story.
Wow.
Hey,
Wow. That's great. Okay, don't make me get all mushy.
We can stop if you need to get emotional.
I mean, I do.
If you're using your advice, if you need to take a break, we'll take a break.
Thanks, Jess.
If you, like, you are an educator, you are an investigator, you are a writer, you are also an entertainer. It's part of the show of show business. Yeah. What entertains you? Where do you go to be entertained? Like Broadway or their movies or certain things on TV?
My wife and I have been binging like every single bit of British crime drama that's out there. We're plowing through them one by one. So that I'm doing that. What am I reading right now? I just finished Michael Connelly's book, a new book called Resurrection Walk, which is terrific. And I'm into, Henry Winkler's new autobiography, which is great.
I've heard phenomenal things.
It's called The Fonz and Beyond. And it's about some of the stuff I talked about. It's about how being yourself is enormously rewarding. And when you sort of figure out who you are and stop being the person that you think everybody else wants you to be, you're going to be a lot happier.
I can't wait till the Josh Mankiewicz autobiography comes out. I'll be the first one to get it.
King of Pain, I think is the title.
God's Wingman. Yeah.
God's Wingman. Sweet. I don't know that. I know John Quinones and I used to talk about writing a book about local news, but we never got any farther than the title, which was "I Saw You at the Mass Murder and Your Hair Looked Great."
What a perfect line.
Which we should have written, which we still may. Maybe we'll still write that.
I would definitely pick it up off the shelf with that title alone. Right. Have you ever been asked to do a cameo in a movie?
I was asked to have my voice be a cameo in a movie some years ago, a real movie with Denzel Washington in it. I don't know what the rules are now at NBC. At the time they were like, that's a great idea. No, like they weren't even like, they wouldn't even consider it like that. That took like 30 seconds. The phone rang longer than the conversation that I had with the standards guy. And I wasn't saying my name or anything. I think it was going to be me like saying something in the background while, you know, Denzel or somebody else was reacting to the news, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. My brother's played a newscaster a couple of times, I think.
Oh, has he? Oh, interesting.
Yeah. He's been like newscaster number two.
I always thought that would be interesting because, you know, like how the Simpsons will take people just like yourselves and then let's insert them in the middle of this crazy episode.
Well, I mean, I'm saying I don't know because back then, this was in the 90s, I think, that I got turned down by NBC and I didn't ask again. Not that I exactly have a million offers coming in the door. But more recently, I played myself on camera, not just my voice, on Curb Your Enthusiasm a couple of seasons ago. And which was hugely there is no show that makes you cooler by appearing on it.
And just my reaction right now, that's everybody's reaction. Like of all the shows you could pick, like that would be definitely top three, right?
The Simpsons maybe. I can't even think of anything else. The great thing about it, of course, is it was supposed to be Lester Holt, but he had come out to LA to shoot it, but then he had to leave to cover tornadoes for nightly news in Alabama, which had killed a lot of people. And I think they'd put it off a couple of times and they could not put it off again. And like they were shooting it the next day. And so they said to, you know, to Curb, to Larry David, it's not going to be Lester, pick somebody else. And he was like, where's Josh Mankiewicz? So the next morning I'm on the Curb set. And I wasn't, they didn't say to me, do you want to be on Curb? I mean, Liz called the executive producer and said, do you want to be on Curb? I'm like, I got a lot going on. She's like, I put that wrong. I'm like, oh, okay. Yes. When am I going to be on Curb? So I went out there and I shot a scene with Sean Penn.
What?
And I shot a scene with Jonah Hill. Oh. And I shot a couple of scenes with Larry. And then like a year went by, right? And it's all improv. There's no lines, right? You know?
Beautiful.
So I show up on the set. It's like 7 a.m., right? And I'm in this pet store that they've taken over. And the producer comes out and he says, you're doing a story about how Sean Penn has bought a bird store. Go. I'm like, whoa, just a second. Like I've never been an actor before just now. And I don't even get any lines. So we did it a couple of times. It was okay. And they'd come out and they'd be like, all right, I like this is good. That didn't work. Stand over this way. Lean that way. When you're talking to him, look like that, you know? So we did it like four times or something. And that was it. Then we did the rest of it. And then like a year goes by and I hear nothing from them. I'm like, nobody calls me. Nobody writes me, nothing. I'm like, I'm glad I didn't tell a lot of people about this because this is never going to air. They've clearly gone in some different direction. And I'm watching the season as it's progressing because I watch Curb anyway. And one of the things I said in the interview with Larry that I supposedly did, the fake interview with Larry that I did for the show, they used the line that I wrote and they gave it to Vince Vaughn, who was on. They have him say it. I'm like, okay, now I know it's not going to be on, right? because they actually gave away some funny thing I said to somebody else. I'm like, good. I'm glad I didn't tell anybody about it. Done, right? And then that night, the episode ends, and they say, coming up next week. And the first thing in coming up next week is me asking, and I'm on camera, is me asking Larry a question. And I didn't have three words come out of my mouth before the phone started to ring, right? And it, like, I heard from people I hadn't heard from since, like, high school. They all wanted money. No, just kidding. That's not true. And then it ran. And then except for the one line that Vince Vaughn, they used everything I shot.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. It was a fabulous experience. And spoiler alert, Larry is not crazy and unpleasant and neurotic. He's actually extremely nice in person.
I've heard that. He's a hero of mine. That's a guy I would love to meet. But that's way better than it was going to be, which was going to be amazing. But you also were in the episode. You did your part. It went awesome. But you wrote a line for Vince Vaughn.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Okay,
that's,
I didn't really think about that, but yes, that's true. Yeah, I did.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, we've kept you for so long, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate this. I do. I mean, I feel like that story probably has a piece of this in it. But I want to end on I want to hear a deep, dark Josh Mankiewicz secret that most people don't know about you. I want you to tell it to us. Just us. Just this.
I feel
just
like we're
between
just,
us.
Just like
circle of trust.
Yeah. I feel like we're indoctrinating you into our church now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Spill the tea. Give out the blackmail ammo.
Huh.
So we came full circle. So,
well, I like it, Jessica. That's why you're a pro.
Should have thought about this a little bit more.
Oh, I've stumped Josh.
Well, let's see. What can I?
The glory of editing. You can take your time, find the perfect thing you've never said.
And we'll just edit out this giant pause.
Yeah. And what you say, we're actually going to put Vince Vaughn in and have him say it.
So. Perfect. Perfect. Okay. Well, when the Bill Hader imitation of me came out with him saying in my voice, most people, when they find a dead body, they call 911. But you didn't do that, did you? When I heard him do that on Kimmel, I turned to my wife and said, I don't say that. Right? And my wife was like, yeah, you do all the time about everything. Yeah. What? You don't say, no, that's that. You don't say anything else, she said to me. Yeah.
That is like the best full-on Dateline impression I've ever seen. I love it. And Todd, if you haven't seen it, I got to send it to you.
Oh, it's epic.
I have, and in fact, he does Keith as well, right? So
he does Dennis, which is amazing. I would have said you can't imitate Dennis, but he did it. He was perfect. It was perfect. And I've never met Bill Hader, but if I ever run into him in a restaurant, he better be ready because I'm gonna hug him.
So loved it. That's awesome.
Oh yeah. He's my favorite person who does impressions, period, bar none. Yeah. He does the most. He's amazing and he's hilarious outside of that. So why you have to feel good. Bill Hader just did an impression on me on Kimmel. Like that's amazing.
It was great. Yeah, I'm sure 2020 was thrilled to see that on their air. It's great. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm not going to close it out. I'll let her close it out. But I personally want to thank you for your time. I laughed very hard. And the conversation was something I'll remember for a good piece. So thank you.
Good. Thank you. Nice to see you guys again.
Yeah. And what the really cool part about when this episode is going to come out, the podcast we worked on together is Nice and Out. And people can binge it and we'll have a title by then. And
who knows what it's going to be called? Yeah.
It's Todd and my Christmas gift to our listeners is Josh Mankiewicz.
Yeah.
Happy holidays.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to all.
I am such a Josh Mankiewicz super fan now. I was already a fan, but now that I know he's hilarious, super fan.
He really is one of a kind and someone I've admired for many years. So for me to have the opportunity to work with him has been an absolute dream. I was especially honored to work on his latest podcast, which, as you heard in this episode, the name wasn't yet solidified, but now it is. Mortal Sin is Josh Mankiewicz's newest true crime podcast from Dateline NBC. And by the second day of its release, it skyrocketed to the number one spot on the Apple podcast chart. And if you haven't listened to it yet, guess what? Now you can binge the entire series. And it's got everything. Sex, murder, religion. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one. Make sure you check it out wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You can find everything we just mentioned, including Mortal Sin, in the show notes for this episode at investigatorspodcast.com. And while you're there, check out some behind-the-scene photos of us hanging with Josh at CrimeCon. That's like name-dropping, except with photos. Plus, there's a link to Josh's appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm, which, trust me, was epic.
Until next time, take care, and take care of each other.
And please, do us one little favor. Find Josh on social media and thank him for coming on our little show. And remember to tag us, because we're the investigators.
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.